From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And ahoy there, and a very warm welcome to a special three-part edition of Are You Not Entertained? Over the next few weeks, we're going to focus in on the shaping and the future of sport beyond COVID. A journey that might take us longer to travel than some in media and government would have us believe. At the heart of that industry reforging will be the urgent reskilling and new attitudes required from our leaders in the sports space. So we asked our friends at SRI to help us speak to some of the key people in the industry, the serious heavy artillery, to help move the agenda along. And they've done us proud, offering an array of talent that will make for compelling listening in the weeks ahead. So firstly, and in a remarkable change of costume from the Grand Inquisitor to the industry expert, is my co-host, the feisty terrier from Como, Roger Mitchell. Hello, Roger.
Hi, Captain. How are you? I'm not sure about the industry expert, but I'm very honoured to do this. You know, we started the first of these specials with, you know, repricing risk in sport. And, you know, the next big theme that we think, you, me and Grant think, is how, as you say, sports need to reskill. New people coming in, new generations with different outlooks. And, you know, it's great that you know, the industry leaders and all of this SRI are going to help us get through this over the next 3 weeks. And I really like, you know, this week that we've got two guests who are relatively new into their roles, which means that they will have their inboxes full of change management and, you know, making an impact in the famous 100 days and first 100 days. So I think this is bang on, and well done you for organising it.
Well, bless you. Bless you, comrade. It's good. And I think it's also important is that a lot of people say when feedback on our show is that Roger does often have opinions, but sometimes you have to sort of listen to others. So you're allowed to answer questions. And I think people will love to hear it when you get off the fence, which is not your natural place, let's be honest. So joining us around the virtual oak table, which other listeners may remember from the captain's table, it's the same one. It's a fine English oak. We've got a cracking lineup. Anna-Marie Phelps was chair of British Rowing from 2013 to 2018 and has served as vice chair of the British Olympic Association since 2017. And in 2019, Anna-Marie was appointed chair of the British Horse Racing Authority and has been at the heart of the sport's brilliant COVID response. And at the other end of the table, with Roger mediating, we're joined by Jo Coates. Jo started her career in the sports industry in football before progressing to head up commercial operations at England Netball. She was promoted to CEO in 2015 and oversaw a period of unparalleled success on and off the court. She then moved on to join the London Legacy Development Corporation before being persuaded back into governing body world, something Roger didn't do, when taking on what she describes as the toughest job in British sport, the CEO of UK Athletics. She's not wrong there. And our final crew member, no, she's not. Our final crew member is the Warwick the Kingmaker of our modern times, Mr. David James, not the goalkeeper, but the man who is known as the head of sport at the global search and consulting firm SRI. He works with rights holders, federations, clubs and brands, helping to identify and appoint a raft of executive and non-exec leaders. And everybody wants to be his friend. Two of his most notable appointments were Anna-Marie and Jo. So let's get them on board. A warm welcome to you all. Please find a seat around the table. It's rather difficult to know what topic to start with when one's thinking about the future of sport, or indeed with all of you who I should pick on first. But let's go alphabetically. Anna-Marie, if you could, for our listeners, share with us something of what it must have been like on those opening sort of days, weeks, months at the BHA as the tendrils of COVID struck, and you had to set about preparing a response to coping with something that no one in the modern world has ever had to cope with before. What was it like?
Well, it was extraordinary because we actually stopped racing before we were forced to. So we had to make that decision. And getting people together around the table to try and make the right decision, both for the sport, but also sort of for the country, it was a sort of ethical, moral decision to make. It wasn't easy at all to know whether or not it was the right thing to be doing at the right time. We'd had a brief stop in racing with equine flu not so long ago. So we'd kind of had a practice for this, but nobody quite knew what was going to happen with COVID and how long it was going to go on. So it was a scary moment, actually.
And how did you set about gathering your front bench all around you? I mean, presumably there was some people who perhaps rose to the top that you might not have expected because this was something completely different and certainly nothing you could plan or indeed interview for.
Well, I must be very careful not to take too much credit for this because it was really an executive delivered thing. And I'm merely the non-executive chairman, of course. So, but you know, we have a really complicated structure in horse racing, but what it does mean when a crisis hits is that you have to get everybody together around the table. You know, you have to have your race courses and your trainers and somebody representing the owners and everything else. So really was an industry effort to put people together, and then you just bring in, you know, your execs, your specialists in different areas, in comms, in disease, you know, the doctor around the table to look at, you know, what's the prognosis sort of thing for this. And of course, your public affairs team, because a lot of this was driven by, you know, what was happening in government at the time and what was likely to happen.
And I was going to ask, how were the government, the UK government, and this show goes all over the place, but governments all over the world would have been faced with exactly the same thing. How was it to deal with government as they were also unpeeling something that they were new to?
They were good, actually. I mean, I think the fact that we made the decision ourselves. We got everyone around the table and had a big meeting of all our members and said, you know, look, here is the situation. This is what we think is going to happen. This is what we're hearing is going to happen. We need to be in control of this decision-making so that we can be in control of coming back. And let's start now preparing to be safe for the future. So I think, you know, the fact that we did that, I think the government were fine about us making that decision.
And Joe, remind us all, how long had you been? I mean, you had a punchy start, I think is fair to say. I think I've read. So how long had you been in post and all the rest of it before this new world hit us?
I love the idea that it was a punchy start. I'm going to use that in future. I started on March the 18th, and that was actually my first day was a board meeting. And March the 20th, I shut the offices. And that Monday, basically, we all went into lockdown. So I still haven't met the majority of my staff in person. So a very unusual start to a new role as a CEO.
And therefore, did you have to rely on some of the old timers to sort of not just get your... You didn't have to worry about where the water cooler was or where the loos were. You had to worry about who's who in the zoo from home, presumably. Not easy.
No, it's not easy. And obviously, I think everybody knows that UKA wanted to go through quite a lot of change. So I think if it was a really stable organisation, that's very different because you can come in and you've got the experts there and really it would be overseeing something. But we not only had to face a pandemic, but obviously we were straight on the back of a review from UK Sport. So we had to make a lot of change as well. And that's been very unusual, trying to galvanise a team, recruit a new team, change the business while you're dealing with a pandemic. So, punchy is a great word.
Well, I remember that. I think, Anne-Marie, you looked after the... You were responsible for the review of British cycling a few years back when, in my old life, we all had former lives. My old life was running HSBC sponsorship and we'd just taken a very major position with British cycling. And then there was this review. So, in a sense... the regulation that sport, particularly in the UK, has undergone in the last 3 years has probably prepared sport far better for a crisis than perhaps it had this happen 10 years ago. I don't know. Roger, you were you used to be a rights holder type. You were at the Scottish Premier League.
My fair share of crises.
Yeah, yeah. What would you, I mean, you've heard from Jo and Anne-Marie. What's your sort of, and you live in Lake Como, you lucky thing. What would you say, as you've looked from the outside in, how have you perceived that rights holders have fared?
First of all, I would like to commend both of our guests for their courage. I think both jobs that they're going into are perhaps amongst the most difficult. And you know, change management doesn't cover it really, even without COVID. You know, if you allow me, Giles, you know, I am not an expert on horse racing, but you know, I think if one was to categorise that industry, it would be pale, stale, and male. And I think it needs a dramatic shake up. And you know, in the past, people that have tried to do it, maybe not exactly in the governing body, but in the jockey club, that haven't fitted that category, have come to quite a sharp end. So you know, I look at the jobs that have been taken on here, and I really think they have got wonderful courage to try and approach them. Obviously, UK Athletics the same after everything that went through, the Oregon project and Salazar and everything. It doesn't get much harder than that, Giles. And then you throw COVID in the top, and I'm just full of admiration.
Well, there you are.
I would say that the fact that UKA and the BHA have appointed both Joe and I to these roles, though, shows a willingness to change.
100%.
And a willingness to do 100%. Something new. So I think the door is open there, and I think sport really does want to move. I think that people do understand, and they know that they've got to appeal to the widest sense of the population if they're to survive.
I think that is a great point. You know, and you know, people that know me will know that I'm not just saying it today. I think the increased role of women in what is basically a situation that by definition is full of EQ is a great thing, because the woman is a superior machine in that respect. And, you know, my request to anybody that's involved, like SRI, is think a little bit more about, you know, women taking these roles, because in the main, they are more open-minded. They see the wider picture, and they make decisions based on more sophisticated buttons.
Well, David, I was going to bring you in, and Roger's done that in a sense. But I think the sports industry has been mocked for many years for perhaps being a club for blazer-wearing enthusiasts. Which is how I got in, of course. But you've been in the game for a while, and you've seen, well, what changes have you seen in the quality of candidates? And particularly as we're talking about the future, how fit for purpose is the industry to harness maybe the future commercial the future commercial landscape that sport's going to find itself in a post-COVID era? You get everybody's CV. Everybody laughs at your jokes. They hope they're going to be top of the CV pile. I know the truth. They're not worth listening to. But what have you seen?
I think there are two separate bits to that. I think one is the issue of diversity and trying to introduce fresh thinking and a different perspective into sports organisations. I think the other is the question of the shifting commercial landscape. And I think they're not mutually exclusive, but I think the two are different. And if I think about the two processes that I worked on with Joe and Anne-Marie, you know, a lot of this was about ensuring they understood what it was they were going into and the challenges that were there. And part of that becomes quite self-selecting, because for certain candidates, that's something they don't want to take on. And that's an entirely sane decision to make, by the way. For others, actually, it's part of the appeal is the fact that it is a difficult landscape. It is going to require sophistication of approach emotional intelligence, political savvy, etc. So I think organizations are aware of the fact that there are opportunities to think differently and behave differently. I think on the commercial side, it's actually a bit more binary. I think that, and Joe will talk much more knowledge about this than I can, but you know, the basic truth is that the commercial model has shifted unrecognizably in the last 18 months, 2 years. So the traditional model of sponsorship and partnerships has shifted something which is much more now focused on areas we've already touched on, like integrity, like sustainability, like corporate social responsibility. What is it this association will do for my organization beyond just a branding exercise? And therefore, organizations need to be smarter about how they approach their commercial strategy and the sort of people they want to bring in. As I said, these two aren't mutually exclusive, but I think they are two fairly distinct parallel lines that are running, facing sport, as I said, across the world at the moment.
That's interesting. And we'll come back to the commercial model, because I'm interested, having been a former buyer. But I wondered, Joe, has lockdown, we talked about being a punchy sort of opening barrage of opening bowling for you, but now that you reflect back on nearly a year, has the lockdown provided you with any opportunities that maybe you wouldn't have had there not been a lockdown? Do you reflect and go, it's given you some space and time or anything that might help in the long term?
I think probably very similar to other people, you know, the fact that we can now work in a more virtual environment actually opens up recruitment processes. So I think that, and I think that's probably the answer that lots of people would give. For us as a sport as well, virtual racing is really big now. So it's offered up, you know, great opportunities there for people who, obviously the club structure is fabulous, but people who can take on virtual racing as well. So I think those are two things that probably a lot of organisations have found. I think specifically for UKA, because of the point that we were at and the point within the change management piece, for us actually having this lockdown time where we're not doing normal business has allowed us to really look at the business much more closely, because otherwise we would have operationally just continually been delivering. So for us, it's given us an opportunity to really dig deep, sort out some of the stuff that needed sorting out that previously, if we had been doing what we do as a day-to-day job, we might not have been able to react to as quickly. So specifically for us in athletics, that has been a major opportunity. And certainly for devising our new plan, it's really meant that that's moved on much quicker, I think, than it would have previously. But all the normal virtual stuff that other people have talked about, I think, has opened up lots of doors for us.
And there's a lot of talk about the commercial landscape in sport changing, something Roger and I speak about most weeks on the show. With first-party fan data, data analytics in general, which provide the, I guess, the currency for the investors, sponsors and rights holders to know their consumer in a way that was never possible under the TV model. There is a new currency of value in the sports industry. So are you bullish about the future of the sports industry despite COVID? Anna Marie?
You know, you have to be an optimist, don't you? I mean, it has been, we contrast really with UKA at the BHA because we have had business as usual. In fact, we've had even more business than usual because we're dealing with COVID at the same time. So, you know, apart from those first few weeks when there was no racing, we have been putting on racing daily and weekly. So there hasn't been quite the same change. But I do think that, you know, the opportunity for someone like racing, our eyeballs on terrestrial television, for example, have really increased. ITV have done a fabulous job for us. It's not as straightforward for us because we have disaggregated sort of media rights. You know, the race courses through their media companies are selling theirs. So we're not in the same position that a normal governing body would be in terms of negotiating those. But I do think that, you know, in terms of just getting people to watch the sport, there's been a fabulous opportunity. And in terms of talking about the good things that are going on across the sport, talking about diversity, talking about community projects, you know, there's been a lot more interest in the sort of stuff that's around the sport as well and the people, and it's given people an opportunity to really meet the journalists and things. the jockeys, I mean.
I think that point that Anna-Marie and Joe have both made about breathing space is really key, because I think the reality is the ability for these organisations and other rights holders and clubs and federations to actually proactively start planning and thinking ahead 12, 18 months down the line has always been compromised by the need to deliver, just functionally to deliver the product that is the day-to-day product. And there's no question that this has been an opportunity to look at structures, to look at the nature of the consumer and how that's shifting, what content organizations need to provide and how that needs to shift and change. And we've certainly seen in discussions we've had with clients a real shift to a slightly more strategic kind of outlook in terms of not just the short term, but actually the short, medium and long term. Where do we need to get to as an organization? And COVID has provided that opportunity for both from a breathing space point of view, but also because it became clear very early on that the status quo wasn't an option. So organizations had to evolve and change. It was just a question of how radical they could be or wanted to be that was going to drive that.
Well, what was very interesting, we had Dan Heal, who is at Control Risks, who are one of the big risk consultancies, global ones, who cover all of the industries, oil and gas, banking, finance, all of it. And listening to him talking about COVID is not like reading the Daily Mail about what's going to be happening and what the reality is about coming out of lockdown. It's going to be staggered, because I was fascinated watching the England versus India test match over the last few days. And I was following on Twitter, and so I was, oh, it's amazing. In India, they're not wearing face masks. That doesn't mean it's over. They're just at a different stage. And therefore, global travel is going to be affected. The calendar change, everything is going to be affected. So for me, it's all of this is intriguing. Joe, I was wondering as well, what's the latest? I mean, actually for both of you, but what's the latest with Tokyo, the Olympics, the pinnacle of so many sports? What's the latest information coming out?
Well, I think we were both on a call probably about 10 days ago with the BOA and the BPA, and it was very clear that the IOC want everybody to know it's not whether or not the Olympics and Paralympics will be occurring, but how they do it. And that's very, very clear. We have very clear instruction that it will be happening. It's just what it might look like and how it will happen will be probably very different, but we are still preparing all of our athletes with the view that they will be going to Tokyo. Now, whether people like myself and Anne-Marie will be going, probably not is the case this time. So we'll probably miss out on a trip to the Olympic and the Paralympics, but athletes at this moment in time will definitely be going.
And do you liaise with other athletic organisations around the world? Do you compare notes?
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we've got our European indoors in a couple of weeks. So again, we'll be talking to the other European federations to ensure that they're sending teams to make sure, you know, we're not going to be the only people that rock up in Poland. So yeah, there's a lot of shared learning there. But really, I mean, the BPA and the BOA, I've got to say, they've kept us incredibly well informed as to what's happening, what will be happening. So I think there's a comfort there probably within the governing bodies, and we need our athletes to feel that comfort coming through, because this actually is all about the athletes. It's not about us. It's about the athletes. This is what they train for years and years and years. So I think we have to make sure that they're comfortable and have got the information and still trained to the best of their abilities to go and win medals.
And I think one thing we can give them is certainty. I mean, we can give them as much certainty as we can that, you know, they're doing the right thing and they're on the right track, so that they can perform if they need to. Because it's really interesting looking from a rowing perspective. For me, I sit on the European Rowing Board, and all the European countries are training in different ways. Some of them have carried on all the way through. Some of them have gone into isolation and come out. Some are training on their own. But, you know, we had four European championships last year at different age groups. We've got four planned this year at different age groups and different disciplines. And I'm pretty sure they'll happen, even though we've got nothing in these sorts of sports happening here.
And Rod, I think you're pretty bullish about OTT, which is related in terms of how sports can best present themselves going forward, particularly in these different times where staging is different. Do you think that sort of sports streaming in the new landscape is going to be one of the saviours of the sports industry, particularly after this these sort of rather tectonic plate shifts that have been happening?
I think, you know, stepping maybe a couple of steps back, the the bank for sport of the last 30 years has principally been sports TV, pay TV channels. Their world is changing for the reasons that I think we all know. And when your bank changes its way of doing business, it's going to affect you. So my view, which may or may not be true, is that many sports that are not the absolute premium level, and I think that does include horse racing and athletics, are going to struggle to get the bids that they had before from pay TV. So from what was traditionally a B2B model, and if you put it in the simplest terms, you did the TV contract, you did the sponsor contract, and then you sat back for 4 years. I think you are going to have to get into the world of ARPU, lifetime value, cost of customer acquisition, retention, churn, the skills of Spotify. That's why I really like this podcast, because I really ask myself, does sport have these skills? Today, it doesn't. And guys like David are going to have to work real damn hard to get them into sport quickly. And then, of course, they will get resistance from the pale, stale and male, as I call it. So direct-to-consumer as opposed to OTT, I like to make that distinction. Direct-to-consumer, building a community, increasing its engagement and then monetizing it, I think can be the only playbook if you're not a Formula One or an NFL or a Premiership or a Champions League. So, you know, I will watch from Lake Como to see how quickly those new skills that come from outside sport will make a difference.
But presumably that's the exciting thing as well. I've received sponsorship proposals from both organisations. In fact, I've received sponsorship proposals from everybody over the 12 years I was at HSBC. And one of the things that I remember about both sports, coincidentally, is that you have an enormous following and there is an interest level, but not necessarily in the old money of the TV product that could support it in the way that football could. But if you start to then index and segment against people who are interested in horse racing and you know about them in a different way, which OTT obviously provides because it's a data stream that is owned, suddenly the appeal to the sponsorship community, I would imagine, is significantly more. And presumably one of the things that you've both been really looking at is the broader appeal.
Yeah, completely agree. I mean, when you look at our sport, obviously we don't have a broadcast deal at the moment. And don't get me wrong, we would absolutely love to still be on terrestrial TV. But we are creating new ways of developing content and pushing that content out to our fan base. And a big part of the work that we want to look at is, you know, there are 7 million recreational runners in this country. How do we turn those 7 million recreational runners into fans of our sport? And we think we can do that through digital content, through, you know, sort of the behind the scenes stuff, talking about our athletes, but also this just short format clip. Athletics is perfect for that. Because it's such a, you know, it's a bit like horse racing. People are just, you know, the people or animals are just racing against each other or seeing how high they can jump or how long they can throw. So we're absolutely creating that separate content stream. We hope to get a broadcaster, as I've said, but the monetization and the value really is in those 7 million people who put a pair of trainers on.
And Anne-Marie, that must be exactly the same. And I think anybody who's been horse racing, if you're David James, you are something of an expert. And I genuinely mean that. If anybody in the sports industry wants a tip, as not just for a new job, but actually for a decent nag, speak to David James at SRI. And I've known him many years. But Anne-Marie, in all seriousness, you go to a Cheltenham, you go to the National, you go to, frankly, Exeter. There's a lot of people there having a lovely day out on whatever level they want to have a good day out at. It's all, you don't have to be an expert. You can be very occasional. Presumably that is what, for you and your executive team, something that you are really excited about.
It's really interesting. So we have a fantastic following. I think we're the second biggest spectator sport to football, which is extraordinary statistically. But we have a really good mix. We have over 40% of people that are race goers are female. There's a really nice mix of people from all socioeconomic backgrounds. Diversity in other ways isn't necessarily always as good as it might be, but we're definitely working on that. And, you know, I think the issue for horse racing is that the rights to the data rights and the media rights are all held separately. So the race courses and the race, we've got two big race course groups, which have their own different media groups. We have the extraordinary luck of having a daily newspaper for our sport. We have two dedicated TV channels, and we have racing on a terrestrial channel every week. So, you know, the opportunity is there. If you could accumulate all that data and if you could get people to work together, you know, we'd really be able to drive something very, very exciting. The issue is this sort of disaggregation, the potential for things to leak, both, you know, financially, but also in terms of knowledge, and just not to make the most of what we've got.
And David, are you seeing that therefore? I mean, you get candidates across all the time. Are you seeing this shift? I mean, the things that they've just both been talking about, Joe and Anna Marie, this would not have been a conversation 10 years ago.
So I think there are two bits here. There is one is the issue of the aggregation of rights and creation of kind of 1 and 1 makes 3 in terms of content. And to Joe's point, using that content in a way to engage new audiences. Same for Anna Marie with horse racing. Clearly, this is about targeting existing fans. And the great sort of challenge, it seems to me, that organisers in the rights holders in the industry have is how do you evolve your proposition that doesn't make it unrecognisable to the hardcore fan, that still appeals to the kind of core constituency, but also is a recognisable form or something different and compelling that a new audience will come to. Now, the example that gets wheeled out a lot is T20 in cricket as being an example of something which is an adaptation or an evolution of the sport that has been specifically designed to appeal to people who don't have the time or the interest to spend 5 days watching a test match. I think versions of those conversations are happening with every rights holder and federation now, which is we have our core constituency, we need to continue to give them what they want, but we also need to find a way to cut through what is a very cluttered marketplace. And that is not just about consumers consuming the product, it's actually about people participating as well. So it's about kids deciding aged 8 that they're going to go to their local track club and do that on a Saturday morning rather than the other 25 things that an 8-year-old kid could do on a Saturday morning within 10 minutes of their home. And I speak with feeling of an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old boy. You know, there are literally 20 or 30 different things or clubs they could join. What is it that organizations are doing to make children attracted to that from a participation point of view? Because actually, at the heart of all these organizations, there has to be a recognition of the fact that actually progressing and evolving the participation in the sport needs to be as critical as almost anything else.
And Rog, again, outsider looking in, but having been an insider, I think I'd love you to share the story. I think that you looked at all sorts of different models maybe 20 years ago in terms of broadcasting. You were trying to innovate a long way back, weren't you?
Both in terms of formats and where we tried to bring all the smaller leagues that were going to be marginalised by the changes in football into what was called the Atlantic League, and that's still around, that idea. So creativity in formats, which David was talking about there, and then creativity in league-owned channels, the famous one being SPL Television, which would have been, you know, the forerunner of what today is pretty clearly called OTT or something like that. You know, I think two things listening to this conversation here. Athletic strikes me that, you know, one of its problems is that its high-profile events just don't come around often enough. You know, I remember when I was a teenager, it was every weekend, probably Friday and Saturday, you had the Golden Mile and things like that. And that was great times for athletics. But now it's really 1 in 4 years. And I think that's an issue for the IOC in general. That's not sustainable, not in the attention economy of today. You can't run a sports property that... And then why do I say that? Because coming back to the point about participation, if you look at netball and the wonderful work that was done by Joe, their participations went up. It's because of success. So you need to see, youngsters need to see aspirational athletes doing well, and then they start taking up the sport. I just don't think athletics is on enough for that to happen. Once in 4 years, it's really tough to keep the attention. In terms of horse racing, I think, you know, if you look at the way all other sports are going, there's just not enough done to make personalities of the jockeys. It's strange in some ways that the horse is still the main protagonist of horse racing, whereas I personally think to make it successful, you need to create the kind of rivalries that you get in darts and you get in snooker between the jockeys. And, you know, those are the challenges that I see, having been, as you say, Giles, somebody that, listen, I'm more a revolution than an evolution guy. I would be more pessimistic than optimistic about the next 5 years of sport, because, as I say, the bank ain't going to be there anymore. And I, again, admire so much people taking on these really difficult challenges. I mean, let's not even talk about, you know, betting and, you know, the affordability review that's coming down the line for horse racing. That's going to take so much out of the sport. The challenges are all over the place. Younger audiences look at things differently. The skill set required that David is going to have to find in candidates is like NASA level, I think.
Well, no pressure, David.
Joe was going to say something, and I'll jump because I agree with what you're saying, Roger. But I think also these things need to be done in slightly bite-sized chunks, as in what we know doesn't work is bringing into an organization or a federation or a rights holder a mentality of complete transformational overhaul in a short period of time, because the body rejects the organ. It doesn't matter how willing, to Anna Marie's point, how willing an organization says it is to adapt and change. There is a simple practical reality that I think informs that. So I think you have to think about people who've got a mindset and an approach that can adapt and can help an organization to evolve. Some of this will be born out of the fact that there are, what COVID has provided is an opportunity, because the status quo doesn't exist as an opportunity anymore. So some of the resistance that may be baked into organizations to change can get swept away, I think, more easily. But Joe, you were gonna come in on the point on the athletics.
Yeah, I was. No, thank you. And Roger, you're absolutely right. I think athletics doesn't have a year-round narrative. It just doesn't. So And that's exactly what we're looking to create. So to go hand in hand with what might be a new broadcast property is to create, probably the same as lots of sports are doing, but shorter format, event specific, telling a story over a few weeks to link our British champs with Com Games, with Olympics, with Worlds, so that fans are permanently engaged, because we absolutely do not have that at the moment, and we've recognised that. I think I feel very optimistic about that. Where I feel slightly pessimistic is then you have to commercialise those. And that comes down to access to facilities and making sure that we can sell enough tickets that actually commercialise them if we don't end up with a broadcast partner, which, again, I'll state again, I truly hope we do end up with a broadcast partner. So I think all of those we're looking at. And coming to your point around the right people within an organisation to deliver it, you're right, in my 20-something years, you know, these are not traditional sports development people you need within governing bodies anymore. And I do think it's quite interesting when you look at the skills matrix on a board. You know, for me, somebody who is ingrained in the coaching or officiating, I'm not sure that's what some of the biggest sports need anymore on their board. I think you need 100%. Media experts. I think you need digital experts. If sport is going to change, those are the sorts of people we need to see coming through our boards rather than the traditional board makeup.
100%.
And I think if there's been one shift we haven't talked about in the commercial sports landscape and the rights holder landscape in the last 2 years, it has been the makeup of boards. It has been the need organisations have now, I think, recognised. Even if you went back 5 years, let alone 10, 15, 20 years, boards would be lacking diversity in every sense, right? They would generally be made up of former competitors, former athletes, people well-known, well-regarded, liked for what they'd done. Whereas you look at it now and the conversations we're having with organisations about about the value that objective oversight can offer on issues from integrity to marketing to comms to digital. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And actually, the great advantage sport has over most other areas is the appeal for people to come and join a board is considerable. People are emotionally affiliated with sport in a way that they aren't with other products and other sectors. And therefore, the opportunity does exist for organizations to be able to attract world-class talent in as non-executive directors or advisors or whatever it may be, who will offer a degree of insight that was never there previously because it was, show me your medals. If you haven't got your medals, you're not credible, you're not qualified to have an opinion. And I think there has been a gradual dawning realization in that world that actually there are people who may not have competed at the highest level as a horseman, as an athlete, whatever it may be, they can still offer enormous value and actually arguably greater value than those from within the organization and the sport.
That's come with the sort of the almost professionalization of sport. I mean, it really isn't that long ago. I mean, I remember rugby union professionalizing and that sort of change almost immediately from Blazerati to having this sort of much more commercial mind. You know, that, and it's been increased by the changes that the Code of Governance, for example, have put in, because people have to turn over. So you can't have a 20-year space on the board anymore. You know, you're going to have to look for somebody new. So all of those things, I think, have helped. But it'd be interesting to know, David, whether you think that actually during COVID in the last 12 months, whether that's accelerated or not. Because I think most of that was happening already. People were already looking for those new opportunities. And you know, sport is not just sport anymore. It's quite challenging when you're doing the whole grassroots to elite. Because at one end, you've got this almost international entertainment business. And at the other end, you're running or helping to run little charitable kind
100%.
Of soccer. You know, that's a massive challenge.
I think the key to that seems to be is not trying to solve it in a single move. Because as you say, if you try and find somebody or an individual, whether it's as an executive or a non-executive, to come in and solve that gamut of issues, as you say, from grassroots through to elite, you really are making life difficult for yourself. If you break it down into areas of functional expertise and areas of insight, and I do think integrity, I mean, you've been closely involved, both of you, with reviews recently and independent assessments. You know, the reality is, I think everybody would acknowledge that, you know, there will be other organizations that face many of the same challenges in the coming months and years. There just will be. And organizations now understand that they need to be in a position not to react and respond, but to actually preempt and prepare for issues around integrity, governance, administration, regulation in a way that, again, previously wasn't, because it was just about who you knew and how that was going to happen. So I think what COVID has done, again, is it's probably sharpened the focus on the fact that organizations are going to have to evolve and think, as you say, more like businesses. But that at the heart of it is this, the simple truth that the shop window or the lens which will do most for any sport in terms of interest, participation, uptake, whatever you want to call, is going to be compelling product that's out there and available, to Joe's point, regularly, not sporadically. If you could repeat Super Saturday, you know, every 4 weeks, there would be a very different world we're living in for athletics.
David, can I ask you something? Yeah. I'm really fascinated by this, because whilst I may sound to be, you know, classically downbeat and pessimistic, I'm actually very upbeat about the young generations. I don't like to call them with a label, Gen Z, but do you think there's a chance here that we skip a generation? Because what I see with the younger kids and their understanding about meme culture, about the attention economy now, about their attitude to paying for content and non-paying for it, and I think they have got, and also they're much more data-driven, much more data-driven. I think my question to you, I would love to hear, do you think there's a chance we're just going to skip and go right to the youngsters?
No, I think again, the organizations who are able to understand, and part of that will be through recruitment and through non-exec advice and all that, who can understand the direction of travel that content is going in, and as you say, how people consume, how willing they are to pay for content, the fact that people don't have appointments to view in the same way that we all did back in the day, you know, you watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it. And as I said, the dad of two young boys, I can see that they are consuming in a completely different way to how we are. I think the reality is, though, that it's a version of the same thing that has always happened, which is each generation comes with a different set of agendas, and the organizations as rights holders who are able to adapt and understand that, I think will survive and will prosper. Those who stick rigidly to a particular method of behaving and conducting will watch that demographic age with them, and then as you said, then that is when they will suddenly wake up one day and realize that they've lost their core audience, and they haven't done the work on bringing the new audience through. So I do think there is something to that. But I also think I have sort of faith that we all tend to look a bit pessimistically at, you know, how the youth today are consuming all that sort of. I suspect our parents felt the same way about us in a different perspective. And I suspect the reality is that we all find a way to find something that is compelling for us. The difference is, I think now there is just vastly more choice.
So fascinating. Who is, for all of us, or for all of you, who's doing it well anywhere in the world? Who do we think is pioneering this change that we're talking about with personnel, with expertise, with different diversity of skills more than anything else? Diversity of skills to ensure that the current and most importantly, the future generations or potential generations of fans are being harnessed. Is a standout for anybody? Rog?
Yeah, I've got one. I've got a standout, Lacrosse, the Rebel Brothers. I think they have understood that sometimes the existing rights holders and governing bodies just won't evolve, and you need to just do it yourself. And that's so funny, because at the end of the day, they've actually consumed the original governing body of Lacrosse. They have got a form of content that's sharp, it's edgy, it's quick. They've changed their business model to a travelling circus. I'm not saying that's perfect, but they're changing. They would be my standout, Giles.
And Anna-Marie, you have a long involvement personally and professionally with the Olympics, both obviously British, but the broader Olympic family, as they like to call themselves. Have you seen any of the Olympic sports from winter or summer who seem to have really got their game going and moved fast, adapted in Darwin speak?
Gosh, I'm really, I will struggle to pick out. I think there are some that have made good steps forward, but haven't really broken through. I think basketball have made some real attempts to sort of break through and haven't quite got there. There are sports like, you know, wheelchair rugby that I think have got real potential to do it. It's really tiny at the moment, but it's a really exciting sport to watch. And they're really sort of keen to get to move forward. So I think there are some that, you know, they're very niche, but if they're in control and they've got their own sort of group, then I don't see why they can't be hugely successful.
And Joe, in your world, and what you said about the bite-sized content which athletics lends itself so beautifully to, as well as a better narrative within the landscape, perhaps you don't want to share with us, but is there some innovation or in your best case scenario that you dream that you'd love to see? Because the basics of running, jumping and throwing are pretty universal. Everybody understands, which is why the fastest person on the world can understand. We all understand what that means, because it's pretty obvious. It's so fundamental. If there were no other governing bodies within athletics and you had free rein, are there stuff that you'd love to do that you just think would help galvanise, or doesn't it work like that?
Well, I think there is, and I'm probably going to get sacked. David, you have to find me another job after this, because there's things I would love to do. I don't understand why long jump you still have to hit a piece of plasticine. I literally am going to be annihilated by the athletics community. But for me, why can't you use digital technology to see where they take off and land? This, you know, the measuring things when people throw with a tape measure, somebody running out, there must be more, some better ways of doing it digitally, so you can show the flight of something like they do in golf. I also think there's some really interesting stuff you can do between the coach and field events. So So again, when people watch pole vault, for instance, Holly Bradshaw, phenomenal pole vaulter. Probably people don't know who she is, and she's absolutely phenomenal. That story isn't told. So still tell the story of the jump.
Yep.
But then also Mike Cut the coach. So when she goes and speaks, he's saying, you know, adjust your body like this. So when you watch as the viewer, you're looking, oh, I see, she lifted her hips slightly more. So I think there's masses you can do in athletics, but I will now be absolutely annihilated by the athletics community for some of those suggestions.
But I think, Joe, it's that's a universal truth as well, in that I think organizations' ability to modernize and use adaptations, digital adaptations like the ones you've talked about, are going to be central to evolution. I think the bit we've already talked about, which is creating a narrative, creating heroes, icons, will always be the most powerful tool sports have to drive interest and participation. You look at, you know, the use of Hawkeye in tennis, in cricket, and the ball, the top tracker in golf. I mean, not in theory an absolutely extraordinarily radical development, but has become so central to our enjoyment of those sports now in a very short period of time. And it feels like it's interesting to see what the next opportunities are for all sports in areas like that. And then the final bit is, as you say, is actually, you've mentioned also, you know, the work that the BHA has done and Jockey Club and ARC have done on creating, doing more to work on Bryony Frost and Holly Doyle's and to understand that there is going to be a degree of human empathy and affiliation that will drive interest if we understand more about these athletes. As you say, there are some brilliant athletes, Joe, who would pass relatively unmolested down the high street if they walked down there tomorrow. And what you want to do is create a situation where people are energized and excited. And you do that, as we're all agreeing fiercely, by creating narratives around them and making them interesting and central to the story. Because otherwise, as you say, you're not getting that cut through, and you're not driving interest in that kind of human way, which I think is so powerful.
And I think one of the big challenges for us in horse racing is we've actually innovated quite a lot during this period of the last year in order to increase eyeballs on terrestrial TV and income through our levy and things like that. Actually holding on to those innovations, making sure that we maintain the interest in Sunday racing, for example, making sure that our fixture list still maximises eyeballs and revenue, making sure that we use opportunities. I mean, Holly Doyle coming third in Sports Personality of the Year, and just that compressed season. I mean, a bit like Joe, I'll be slaughtered for saying it, but the compressed flat season this year was really exciting because people switched on week after week after week and watched the most fantastic horses and jockeys and people racing. So there was a real narrative, and the big risk is we slip back into that comfort zone of what we know once we start to emerge from this.
Well, and isn't the irony, of course, that with technology, the ability to make heroes of individuals has never, ever been easier. Because we now don't have to wait for Grandstand and Des Lynam. For those UK listeners, we can get personalities through all of the channels they own or their governing body owns. It feels to me one of the things that I haven't missed, I'm going to be really honest with you, in the last 12 months, is conferences. And I don't mean conferences for conference sake. I love a conference bar. I'm known for them, and holding forth. But conferences where it seems that the only purpose of them is for people to look back on the last 12 months about how good they've been and how well they've done, rather than maybe talking about this future of what they're going to do or what the challenges are going to be facing them. Because it feels to me this whole conversation and conversations that I think we're probably all having with various people that we work with. I'm working in technology, which is fearsome because I can barely turn on a computer, but there we go, is that you're learning to adapt and to look ahead rather than look backwards. And that seems to be the zeitgeist, is that the industry seems to be galvanized about an uncertain future, which of course then means a future that you have to fight for in order to succeed. David, is that, would you sort of mirror that? And again, the enthusiastic candidates that fall across your desk?
I think if I do look back briefly at the last 12 months, there were three definite moments. There was the initial period of COVID hitting and the impact that had on the sports industry. There was definitely a period of a couple of months of definite pulling up of the handbrake, and we need to see where this is going to go. I'm sure we'll be back by summer. It'll all be fine. Then there was kind of May, June, July time. This feels like this might go on quite a long time. And the conversation shifted towards, we're going to need to start thinking about what we do to plan going forward. And then towards the tail end of last year, actually a number of organizations saying, we can't wait any longer. We now need to move forward. We now need to reflect. And not in a disingenuous way, but use this opportunity. We've talked around it a bit. Use this opportunity to actually implement some fairly radical plans around what it is we need to do and what it is we need to look like. But as I think we've all spoken about today, the reality, and just back to Anna Marie's point about you know, the power of getting that human connection. You know, if I think back to my interaction with athletics, my first real memory was Coo Vet, was those that extraordinary period of time where the two used to race regularly, and you were either an Ovette man or a Coo man, and you had an extraordinary dynamic. You have that with horse races a bit. You have a Quarter Star Demon, or you have a Ruby Walsh AP McCoy type thing. But it is harder. I think where organizations are going now is a pretty simple recognition, which is if they don't adapt and they don't change what it is they present to that new audience, they will not engage that audience. And there is certainly a need to do that in a timely fashion. The challenge is to do it without, as I said, diluting and distilling what makes your sport different and special, and it becoming just a vanilla, anodyne, content-led process. So there was a very difficult balancing act. And from the point of view of people coming into the industry, I've probably done a bit of a 180 in the last 3 or 4 years, from advocating very strongly for the idea of bringing people in from outside sport into certain roles. And I still believe in certain occasions that's a very powerful benefit to organization. But I'm also cognizant of the fact that traditional corporate logic often does not translate well into governing body federation world. And therefore, you can come with the best intentions in the world, but if you don't understand the politics with a small and a big P of how a sport is it works, it's very difficult for you to succeed, however good strategically you are, however smart, however clever, however brave. So there is always a combination of great strategy, great innovation, but also political sophistication that seems to me is not going to go away.
And so there we have in with Anna Marie and Joe, this is the job description that you have had to, as David was placing you, that's what you are, and that's what the future generations will come. That must be exciting, though, that this is that we're looking for the top level. That must feel buoyant as you look through your 10 years, but also handing the baton on elsewhere, Anna Marie.
Yeah, no, it's been really interesting to transition from Olympic sports and my experience in that into horse racing and a professional sport, and to see which bits you take with you and which bits you don't. And actually, a bit like athletics, horse racing is an easy sport. It's the first to cross the line, so that bit is easy. The politics bit and the understanding why people are in it and what they want to get out of it is absolutely the same whatever sport you're in, and managing that side of it. So, you know, I think there is something to be said, as David said, for, you know, bringing people across from one organization, one sports organization to another, for sure.
And a question I wanted to ask you as well is, we live in a more politically pampered world, maybe is one way of putting it. And it's a minefield. And we all know it's a minefield. You can't read the paper and someone's tripped up on some issue or another. Rugby is going through a major challenge right now with concussion and head injuries, which, if they don't get it right, could actually spell the end of the sport, for the simple reason that the insurance won't be there, the schools won't play, and you will dry up of future generations maybe playing sevens. That is the worst case scenario for them. With national hunt racing, is that one of the things that sort of keeps you awake at night a bit, in terms of, I know that safety measures, say the Grand National, have been put in place, etc. But as lobbies become stronger in a way that they never would have done across anything 20 years ago, is that something that you're having to think carefully about?
I think we've got amazing protocols in around concussion and always have done in horse racing. So we're really careful with those and work all the time to try and improve them and other safety measures too. Actually, we've been really careful. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about data, but we use an awful lot of data to predict what might happen under certain circumstances. And that's how we've tried to improve safety on the race courses. So no, that doesn't, because I really think we have the best people in there looking at that. I think we're pretty much on top of it and we're doing all we can do. And I think it's something that we've talked about a lot as a sport, is the danger to jockeys. So yeah, it's just, you know, it's a hard sport and they do get knocks, but we absolutely have that as a priority, and their welfare and the welfare of the horses actually as an absolute priority.
And Joe, from your point of view, if you've got that for racing and rugby, you've got concussion, what are the sort of most challenging on field, on track pieces to athletics that you have to think about?
Yeah, I suppose because it's not a contact sport, and obviously horse racing isn't a contact sport, which certainly is when they hit the ground. It's quite different from our point of view. So really, what we look at is how we can keep our athletes as physically fit and the amount of training days that they can do. That's how we judge whether or not the environment from a sort of a performance point of view is a safe one. But I think, and you know, there's a lot in the press at the moment, what we have to do is make sure that where you have a sport, where you have one-on-one coach athlete, a lot of the times, we have to make sure that people operate in a safe environment. So it's probably less about contact sport and injury, but more about the fact that when it's one-on-one coach athlete, that it's in a very safe environment and no one can abuse their position. That's probably what we look at more so.
And if that's that, I think Joe's spot on. That is the element that is universal across all elite sport, and that pathway through is the challenge you face as a governing body. To the extent to which you can manage safely the welfare of the athletes from a very young age. And there are going to be more and more examples of this. Anna Marie has dealt with it historically as well. You know, the challenges of mental well-being. I have a huge amount done by the BHA and the Jockey Club on that in the last 18 months. It's something that has been really only talked about seriously very, very recently, but it's all part of the same thing Joe's talking about. It's all part about welfare of the athlete, whether they're the elite best of the best or whether they're the six-year-old kid going to the community club to do gymnastics for the first time. It is the sad reality that there are going to be more examples and more challenges for rights holders and federations going forward. It's not going to go away. It is something that organisations need to address.
Well, it's been a 20-year journey, 20-plus year journey. Yeah. I mean, if you think back to when the first real scandals in the UK came out in the late 90s, and obviously with what went on in football back into the 70s. So, but I think you know, at least we're talking about it now, and at least we're in a position to be able to try and manage and help people.
Yeah. Well, and what we're doing is all talking about it, and that's a pretty nice segue to wrap things up, because what has been fascinating for me just listening to all of you with the points of view is that it feels that in a way maybe the sports industry for a long time was not really talking about stuff. It was resting on its laurels. To Roger's point, money would come in from television, sponsors would follow, and the rest, everything could sort of just bumble along for another 3 or 4 years until the next time the next investment was required. Now everybody, I think, feels like they understand that investment is not guaranteed, particularly if there's a lockdown. Therefore, revenues are seriously challenged. And therefore, how can there be this adaptation and also fine tuning and also maybe the cancellation of the things that don't need to continue? So I have to thank you all. I'd like to, in no particular order, thank you, Joe and Anna Marie and David. And it's also a joy for me to have Roger not as the hard questionnaire, but just giving his own wonderful insight. You've all been
It's been brilliant, and I could actually crack on for another hour, but I'd need a pint and beer nuts to go with it, and I can't provide those virtually. So thank you all very much, and we look forward to carrying on this conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Rog, what did it feel like to be on the other side of the table? Well done.
Yeah, I was very impressed with the two ladies, I must admit. It was fascinating to hear them be in those jobs and be dealing with the things that we talk about in theory most weeks on the show. So I was very keen to just listen to them. I think apart from being incredibly impressed, and David obviously is in control of his brief wonderfully, that's clear. I still can't be shaken from our way that, you know, we're in revolution and not evolution. You know, I come from the music business, and in those days, you know, the need to evolve, the majors will always have control. We've got back catalogue. It's all going to be fine. It's now Spotify, completely different player. It's the same in the content businesses where Netflix is making everybody change. So I'm a believer that, sadly, a lot of these organisations don't do change willingly. It gets forced on them. And, they can make little marginal improvements. But at the end of the day, you just follow the money. And the money for most of these sports is going to radically change. And I just thought the two of them gave me a lot of confidence that they're going to look after their sports really well.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I think it's interesting speaking to one of the top recruiters as well, because they have to have their eyes very firmly on the road ahead rather than behind. I think that's all we've got time for this week. Coming up in the next show, we have the CEO of Redbird Capital, Alex Shiner, who looks after all their sports investments, who I think is going to be a fascinating guest for us to have on the big interview, as he talks about what they've been doing, and they've been in the news a lot for both the acquisitions they've made and maybe for some acquisitions which haven't happened. So Alex Shiner's coming.
Gone away,
gone away. And then after that, I'm very excited because on the captain's table, we have the fun bus himself, Jason Leonard, the first prop forward to get to 100 caps, the fun bus of England and British and Irish Lions rugby. Join us on the captain's table. We may need quite a well stop bow.
Yes.
Good. Well, all it remains, I think, I've never done this bit before, but all it remains is for us to make sure that people tell us about how they find the show and if they want to get in touch with us. And they can do that by contacting me at GilesMorgan71 on Twitter. And
you can follow the Twitter handle of the show at Entertained R. That's the word R. And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Until next time, we'll speak soon. Cheers, Rog.
Thanks, Charles. Wonderful.